Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Well, great reaction still coming in to the Eric Von Daniken show, a show so good that it put us right into the iTunes chart. So thank you very much indeed. Tell your friends about this show. The show that we had scheduled for this time is going to run as the next show. We're doing a little bit of rejigging. It's been a long time since we've had to do this, but there's a very good reason for it. On this edition, we have some hotly topical stuff from Gerald Celente, recorded today as I speak these words. We're going to get this show straight out to you. Gerald Celente, of course, global trend watcher, and a man who talks about politics and economics in a way that few other people do. He's a regular on shows like Coast to Coast AM and also Alex Jones. Now, if you don't like politics and you don't like world affairs, then you might want to skip forward 30 minutes in this edition, and then you have Buff Parry. This man is a cryptologist, a code breaker of sorts, who's done some remarkable work on what you might call hidden history. So he's the second guest on this one edition, 191. In the next show, Darren Britton, a medium, but a very down-to-earth medium who's very, very interesting indeed. If you think that mediumship is all airy-fairy and out there, this man may change your mind. He's the next show. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell, a creative hotspot in Liverpool, for getting the shows out to you, and for all of the work that he does, the maintenance and everything else that he does on this show. And thank you above all to you for all of your emails and your contributions to the show. Please keep all of those coming. Go to the website www.theunexplained.tv. Okay, let's not hang about. Guest number one now in the United States, way north of New York, Gerald Celente, global trend watcher. Gerald, nice to have you back on The Unexplained. Your website describes you as a clear voice in a confused world. What does that mean? It tells me that you're stronger than ever, whatever.
Well, I'm a political atheist. I look at things for the way they are, not the way I want them to be. And while my, I'm thrilled that I'm an American, as I say, my blood is Italian, but my heart is American, I consider myself a citizen of the world. So I look at the data for what it is, and I don't skew it to fit a hidden agenda or a special need.
But you do present the data. We see it in the trends research forecasts, the journals that I've looked at, but they seem to point in one pretty clear, or a couple of pretty clear directions that we're being steered towards.
Well, again, you know, when you look at the facts and where they're leading us, if it's the economy, you know, it's very clear. It's the rich of, it's not the 1%, by the way, it's 0.01%. That's who's recovered from the recovery. And then when you look at the geopolitics, you know, what, the cover of the New Trends Journal, we're working on it now, and we're calling it Crusades 2000. It's a term, actually, I coined when I wrote Trends 2000 back in 1996. Nothing's changed. The armor has changed. The weapons have changed. But the same, you know, psychosis and psychotic behavior hasn't changed. Just the flavors are different. The names are different. The places are different. And the weapons are different.
You say nothing's changed, but do you think that the cannon fodder, that's you and I, are perhaps a little more savvy than they used to be? People are learning more, they're looking at alternative news sources?
That's the only way out. And matter of fact, I've been thinking about it a lot. When you hear the same story, everybody believes the same line. And that's what's going on. But still, the mainstream media still has the main focus. When even though the numbers are going down and the amount of people that are listening to them, they still get the major message out there. And for the uninformed, that's what they follow. And they line up as cannon fodder very quickly, very easily. And they're willing to put their lives on the line, no different than World War One. We're going to, you know, save the world for democracy. And so it's The alternative media is the only way out, the way I see it at this point.
But at least people are beginning to ask questions. I've been watching our Prime Minister over here, David Cameron, over the last few days. And you know that in the UK, this is an election year. And it's going to be a big one because there may well be some new forces at play. Over these last days, we've had all sorts of statistics miraculously rolled out that have come out at this time that suggest that the economy is actually hunky-dory now and the rest of Europe is going to hell in a handcart, but we are doing fabulously well. And I think people are starting to question that kind of stuff now.
Yes, they are questioning it. But again, you know, if I were to suggest a business for anyone to get into, it would be propaganda. You can do it very cheaply. It could be transparently stupid, and you'll get great results. So while the people will question it for a while, all they have to do is, well, just like we saw it happen over in France, you know, you have an incident and the whole country rallies around you, false flag or real, fact or infactual, whatever it might be, whatever the situation is. It's easy to rally the sheeple around the flagpole in any country. So yes, the alternative media is the way. It's going to be the way, and we think we are on the cusp of that change right now. Our concern is, do we change before we perish, and follow the belief of what Einstein said? I don't know how the Third World War will be fought, but the Fourth will be fought with sticks and stones. We have psychopaths and sociopaths. You talk about Cameron, we have Bush. How about before Cameron? You got Blair. Before Bush, we had, before Obama, we had Bush. I mean, it's one psychopath and sociopath after another under the names of prime ministers, chancellors, and presidents.
One of the things you say in one of your recent reports is that a thing called bankism, which we have to explain, I think, to our listeners here, has replaced capitalism as the prevailing economic system. What is bankism?
Well, bankism, look at the guy you got running the show over there, Bank of England, Carney. You know, the term Carney, that's a nickname for carnival man, a Carney. And that's all they are, another Goldman Sachs guy. Look around the world. Who's running the ECB? Mario Draghi. Where's he from? Goldman Sachs. Who's the guy that deregulated the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States that made it possible for the banks to become these gamblers, these casinos that gamble? And that was Robert Rubin. Where was he from? Goldman Sachs.
But we're being told over here that those days have gone. You know, all the banks have been cleaned up and we've got a big, big wide eye on them now. So we can't go down that road again.
You know, I have a bridge over here in Brooklyn that you'd really like. I'm telling you, Brooklyn is really thriving these days. I could sell it to you cheaply. Look what the banks have done. I was going through the list. You got this guy who gave the name Too Big to Fail. His name was Secretary under Bush. Henry Paul, he's taking over Boris Karloff's role in Frankenstein movies now. He came out, he's from a Goldman Sachs guy. So here's the deal with bankism. I'll loan you money at almost nothing. You're a good bank. You're a good friend of mine. I'm the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or the ECB. And you can loan it out at anything that you can get. Oh, and by the way, you could also loan it to your buddies in the big businesses over there so they could buy back their stock. Don't worry about it. I'll loan you money at 0.25%. Get anything you want for it, but loan it to the big guys really cheaply so they could juice the markets. Oh, and loan it to those private equity groups and those hedge funds and those investment capitalists so they could do big deals as well, so we could prop up these equity markets and make it look like, for all the stupid people out there, that everything is doing really great as we cut their pensions, we cut their benefits, and by the way, we'll bring their retirement age till after they die. And you know what we'll do? We'll call it austerity measures. God save the Queen.
But Mr. Cameron is saying today that his aim, should he be made Prime Minister next time round, should his party be elected, and this time maybe get an outright majority instead of being in coalition. But whatever he says, his aim is full employment next time round. The good days are back.
Yeah. You know, if he says it, then I must believe it. You know, we got a guy over here who won on the campaign slogan, hope and change you could believe in. No, it's just another fraud. If he hasn't done anything now, what makes you think he's going to do anything later? What's the plan? Tell me the plan. They never tell you the plan.
And we have to be balanced here, because you're not just saying that about him. You're saying that about all of them, aren't you?
Of course I am. As I said, I see them no different than murderers and thieves, Bloods and Crips. You know, as I said, we got Obama before we had Bush. Before that, Clinton, the guy that sold out America more than anybody. It's a corrupt team that's ruining the world. They're sociopaths and psychopaths. You're over there in the UK. How about World War One? Lovely, wasn't it? One of the most avoidable wars in history, other than the wars that followed.
One of the things you said to me a couple of times when we've spoken in the past is that the way that this all works is it's, what is it, bullets, bombs, and bankers. So the answer to the problems systemic within the system are, let's have a war, and then we can thin out the population, we can enrich those behind the people making the armaments, and everybody's happy again.
They're doing it again. You can see how the world is marching to war. You just had Cameron and Obama over here. Cameron came here to talk with Obama. I mean, it was a freak show. Mm-hmm. They're talking. I love how they're going to get Russia too. They're going to punish Russia. Everybody, get this in their head. Napoleon. There's a great chart that was done of Napoleon leaving Poland with 420,000 men. He got back to the Polish border with 10,000 men, but he deserted them. Hitler launched the greatest military offensive in world history, only to be defeated by the Russians. The propaganda going on about how we should hate the Russians has been initiated by the United States, and now it's being carried forth by the puppet states of the UK and NATO countries.
So you're saying that we should do, quotes, nothing about Putin?
It's not out unless you want to do it. When you say we, as we used to say, what you mean of we, you know?
I don't want to do it.
I don't want to do it. It's not my business. And as history shows, Ukraine was part of Russia for how long? So it's not a NATO issue. It's a money issue. And if you don't believe me, anyone could go to YouTube and type in the name Newland, N-U-L-A-N-D, first name Victoria, wife of Robert Kagan, a maniac over here, a neocon that loves hegemony. She is the Assistant Secretary of State. There she is on December 13th, 2013, in Washington, D.C., at the National Press Club, speaking about Ukraine. She's just come back from Kiev. She's the woman that was handing out goodies to the protesters. Over her left shoulder is a Chevron sign. Over her right shoulder is ExxonMobil. Chevron had just cut an $11 billion deal to do hydrofracking. Here she is saying to the group that paid her way that the future of Ukraine is Europe, and Ukrainians are Europeans. This, of course, must be news to those Eastern Ukrainians who consider themselves Russians, but she's the Assistant Secretary of State, so she knows best. And she tells them that the path that they should take, remember, this is in 2013, before the overthrow of the Yanukovych government, is to follow the path set forth by the International Monetary Fund. It was an overthrow of a democratically elected government, whether you like them or not, instigated by the United States and fostered by NATO and the United States' other allies.
So what is to be done?
Let them figure it out themselves. We can't. They don't have water in Detroit. Over 58,000 people are being thrown out of their homes because they can't pay their taxes. We've got slums all over this country. Take a ride on the New York City subways. It's a ride in between the 19th and 20th century. We're going to fix what's going on over there? They can't fix the South Bronx. What are they, kidding?
As we record this, Gerald, there's a report out from Oxfam, which is top of the news over here just this afternoon as we speak. You've probably seen it. The wealthiest 1% will soon own more than the rest of the world's population, according to a study by the anti-poverty charity Oxfam. This is the Wire copy I'm reading now. Its research shows that the share of the world's wealth owned by the richest 1% increased from 44% in 2009 to 48% in 2014, and that's expected to go up to 50% next year. This by the sounds of what you've been saying to me, is no big surprise to you.
Of course not. This is what we're saying. It's bankism. And those are the ones that reap the rewards. It's not capitalism. And capitalism, by the way, there's no such thing as too big to fail. So now we're looking also at the number now that 85 people have more money than half the world's population, 3.5 billion. In the United States, the gap between the rich and the poor is the widest since the Gilded Age. As a matter of fact, it's greater than it was during the Gilded Age. It's a multinational takeover. And it's period, paragraph, it's in front of everybody's eyes. Once upon a time, there used to be mom-and-pop shops. Now it's all a multinational chain in a country near you. And the multinational mob is running the world. As you were mentioning before, what they do, and when all else fails, they get you to war. The banks and the bandits make big bucks on the bullets, bombs, and banks. And as I say here in the States, you want to see six words that killed it. Well, bullets, bombs, and banks are half of it. The other one's Harvard, Princeton, Yale. And you have your vision and division of it over there.
Okay, well, this is a very depressing outlook, Gerald, and it hasn't changed a great deal since we last spoke. Do you not think that the rise of popular consciousness of people, like you said, using alternative media, of people like Russell Brand, who's made a big hit in the United States, apparently. I heard him on NPR only last week. People like him saying, we need to wake up and stand up.
And you're seeing the changes taking place, whether you agree or disagree with him, whether it's UKIP, whether it's Podemos in Spain, whether it's the German parties that are, whether it's the Northern League or the Five Star Movement in Italy, you know, they're making traction against the established governments. And I believe that in the United States, we're going to see a third party movement in 2016. I know of no one that's excited that we're going to have either a Bush or a Clinton back in office. So yes, the future is in our hands, and we are on the cusp. Remember, the Renaissance followed the Black Death, where somewhat 60% of Europe was killed. People were realizing that, hey, what we're doing now isn't working. Let's go back, a rebirth, a rediscovery, a la Romana e all'antica, in the manner of the Romans and the ancients, they used to say in Florence to describe the quality of their work. We're Renaissance ready. We have to go back to a time when there was a level of morality. We have to go back to a time when there was a real spirituality, not a fakeness of it, you know, cloaked in phony religions or people that they like to look up to. And I believe it could happen again, and I think that we're on the cusp of that, because after all, as we see it, it's either do or die. And I also believe that art is the way of finding the true meaning of the human spirit. And again, using that Renaissance model. So out of those people that Oxfam talked about, those that are going to own most of the world's wealth, if a de Medici or two came from the ranks and started putting money into beauty, joy, and greatness, the world would be a different place. So maybe the de Medicis will show up.
But some of these people do give, don't they? They give to the arts, they give to culture.
I'm talking about really giving. I'm talking about giving for beauty and art, as I said. You know, I look at the Bill Gates thing as a big fraud. What are they doing with their money? They're pumping up drug companies all over the world with vaccinations, and they're doing nothing for the arts other than buying it for themselves and hanging it on their walls and driving up the prices of pseudo artists and making it something that it isn't.
But the economy of this country and the economy of your country, it all moves in cycles. The world's economy is cycles. It's up and down. Here in the UK, we're being told we're heading for an up. That does not suggest that there's going to be anything revolutionary happening here anytime soon, does it?
Not unless the people change. But you have a big election coming up, and who knows? You know, UKIP could be changing the course.
But, you know, you've got Russell Brand on one side, who is seen to have no real policy, and nobody's quite sure where he's coming from politically, but he's saying a lot of stuff. And then you have UKIP, So I'm wondering whether these third forces are as good an idea as you might think they are.
It depends on who they are and what they're doing. I believe it's an excellent idea to break up the Eurozone. It just became a conglomerate for multinationals. I never believed in the euro when it began. As a matter of fact, I did a conference and Major was there when it was all in the making. USA Today sponsored it, and I was one of the few people that said that it would work, and then it would run into problems as economies began to collapse. So I think the party, each party is different. There are elements within them and elements that work and elements that don't. I mean, when people talk about anti-immigration, does anybody realize why all this immigration is happening? How many more countries do they have to bomb? What is it? How many million Syrians are displaced because of the war created by NATO and the Arab Little League? How many Iraqis were killed? Over a million? Some several million displaced? Oh, there's immigration problems? Hey, how about down in Africa? What kind of dictator are they going to pop up next? Well, isn't Hollande down there in Mali now, right? Oh, yeah, bringing freedom and democracy. So it's very complicated. Again, I'm an American, and I believe in what the founding fathers of this country established and the roots of it, and that was no foreign entanglements. Rebuild America. We're launching Occupy Peace on May 2nd for the most historic four corners in the United States, right here in Colonial Kingston, New York, the only place where there's a pre-Revolutionary War building on each corner. And it's based on the foundations of which this country was built upon. Washington, a real commander-in-chief, not like these little boys running around, these little chicken hawks. This is the guy that led the troops. His farewell address, no foreign entanglements. Madison, no foreign entanglements. Jefferson, no foreign entanglements. Franklin, no foreign entanglements. So we're launching Occupy Peace on May 2nd based upon the founding fathers to honor them, to bring home all the troops, seal the borders, and rebuild America rather than rebuilding and expanding the military, cyber, and pharmaceutical industrial complex.
And how far do you think you're going to get with it, Gerald?
Well, we're shooting for the moon.
Realistically,
the website is up. It's occupypeace.us. Mm-hmm. We're just launching it now, and there are a number of people that have climbed on board that may make it the greatest success of the 21st century.
But those were the aims, weren't they, of the Occupy people outside St. Paul's Cathedral in London, close to the City of London, and it never really happened for them, did it?
They didn't have any real aims, and they didn't have any program. This is a battle plan for peace. We're going to have takeaways, strategic actions to take, steps to take to bring peace. And again, this is U.S.-based. We say, in any country, you do what you want to do, this is what we're doing. And among the things that we're going to be doing are putting limits on the defense budget. We're going to reinstate the need that Congress vote for any war. Congress has not voted to go to war since World War II? And the maniacs in chief have pushed us into them, whether it was Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Syria?
So this is a manifesto.
Oh, yes. This is an action plan. This isn't just a rally to yell and scream and do nothing.
But who's it for? And you're not a political party.
Well, no, it's going to be, we're putting referendums. We're calling them Proposition Peace. It goes back to direct democracy, like they have over there in Switzerland. So what we're doing is we have a team of legal people that we're going to be working to get it on each ballot in every state. So the people vote. It's direct democracy. We're the ones that fight the wars, and we're the ones that pay for them. Why should we have a bunch of paid-off congressmen and senators telling us what to do when their sons and daughters never go to fight?
So across America, we're going to see a whole series of proposition number whatever it is from California right across to New York State. And that's how you're hoping to do it, bit by bit.
That's our objective, yes.
What are people saying to you about that? Are you getting a lot of support?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as I said, the site is up. We just put it up. We haven't finished it yet, but, putting it up there just to get it going. No, it's huge support. You know, there. I mean, again, we're all, you began by talking about the alternative media, and I was saying that people are only getting one message, and they're sort of speaking from the message that they're getting. But there's that whole other groundswell that's totally against what's going on. Then understands that we, again, it's not me. It was Eisenhower that said it. Again, another general that was a real man that was, you know, in the trenches. And his farewell address, that the military-industrial complex is robbing our nation of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of the laborers, and the future of the children. How much more proof do people need? And the maniac solution to peace is more war. Enough. Enough already. So let's rebuild our nations by not building military machines and machines of hate and immorality, but rebuild a nation, self-sustaining economies.
You're a regular guest, Gerald, on the Alex Jones Show, which I do listen to. You know, he's got a lot of opposition. People don't like what he says and the way that he says it. Are you happy to support everything that man says?
I let everybody speak for themselves. My motto is think for yourself, taught to me by my dear father. May his soul rest in peace. And Alex Jones lets me say what I say, and I have nothing to say about what he says. I've been on Oprah, the Today Show, Good Morning America, virtually every show on Fox, BBC, you name it, I go on it. I say what I say, let people say what they say.
One of the things you're saying in one of the trends research journals that I looked at, and very interesting it was to me, the power of the baby boomers, the boomers, you think that they are a major force for change. Why so?
Because you reach an age, you know, once upon a time in cultures, they used to look up to the elders. Now the baby boomers are becoming the elders. You know, we're approaching 70 years old. You know, I'm not the same guy I was when I was a young kid. I'm not the same guy I was when I was in my 30s, 40s, or 50s. So you keep learning, and you've been around long enough where you could start setting the pace and putting out the information and knowledge for the younger generations to start putting it into action. Again, looking at the revolution in the United States, you know, it was begun by the elders. And so the baby boomers have been around long enough. We have enough experience, knowledge, and a lot of us, you know, have the income ability to make things happen. So I believe the hand is the baby boomers. It is a renaissance of many sorts. You know, we have conferences here, and of course, when you subscribe to the journal, you know, you get to see those as well. We just did one, and we wrote about them in a past trends journal as well. June and Stanley Blum. Stanley and June are 95 years old. Stanley began painting at 80 years old. He just published his fifth book of art and poetry. Very high quality publication. You keep learning. You keep growing. And the baby boomers are in that age right now where they've seen enough of life to know what it is. And they know how, and they can see where it's going to go, and now they can put into practice what they maybe have not done before. And so a lot of them are retired, and now they're going into a second stage. And a lot of them are working because they have to continue working, but they're doing what they want to do, and not what they have to do. So we may see something again going back to the alternative media. This could be the alternative way.
Trouble is, of course, that the rest of the demographic is being, if you follow the line of argument, being bought off by reality TV and the iPhone 6.
And that's okay, because they'll follow anything. If they'll drink phosphorescent Slurpees and do whatever they're told, they'll move in any direction, as long as that force of that direction is available for them to hear and see.
So Occupy Peace is the new big thing. This is all happening, culminating in May. May 2nd. What ultimately do you want to become of that? If we have this conversation in 1 year from now, what do you hope would have happened?
Oh, that our bases around the world are closed, that all our troops come home, and that the money being wasted on war is put back into human spiritual development. And again, with art being a major focus of it, to rebuild the infrastructure of this rotting nation, to build an education system that has some meaning rather than what it is now. You know, to honor thy founding fathers and bring what made America. Look, I'm not a kid and stupid in the sense that, yeah, I know the atrocities this nation has committed, particularly against the genocide of the people that lived here. But there were a lot of great things about this country too, and so we want to restore the great. And we can't restore it. The business of America used to be business. Now the business of America is war. No more to war, as that song goes, you know.
George had a song that went No More War, if that's the one you
forgot.
No More War. I know that song very well. To do what you want to do, you've got to break down a political class, a so-called elite, and you've got to restructure the banking and commerce system. They're two pretty big things to do, because they've been around for a long time.
They were put in rein for a long time. We had the Glass-Steagall Act that prohibited the bankers from robbing our nation. All we have to do is put back into place what already was. And it goes with other acts and laws as well, including Robinson-Patman Act, Sherman Antitrust Act, Clayton Antitrust Act, acts that were put in place so the people would have a level playing field and the multinationals wouldn't overtake us. So the opportunities are there. And as I said, if I see another one big trend happening, it's going to be a new third party in the United States. And one of the ways I made my reputation in my book, Trend Tracking, that I wrote in the late 1980s, I had forecasted a new third party. And for some reason, I mentioned Ross Perot's name. Well, in 1992, that party happened. I believe that party's ready to happen here and ready to happen in countries around the world.
Of course, every time you've had a third party candidate in a presidential election, that person hasn't done particularly well.
No, it hasn't done it before. But that doesn't mean it can't happen again. At one time, they weren't always Republicans and Democrats. There were different parties as well. I think the time is now.
All fueled by the fact that people are listening to sources of information and looking at sources of information that weren't available to them, say, 15 years ago.
Right, because we could have that internet candidate. It can happen. And that can be the way. And who knows, maybe the internet candidate will come forth in 2016.
Do you want to be president? Would you like to be president?
No way, man. Are you kidding?
I just thought I'd suggest that. All right, if people want to know more about you and your work, I know that we're very much on the clock here and your time's limited. Where do they go?
Trendsjournal.com. History before it happens.
Gerald, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. All the best.
Powerful, yes, controversial, sure, as ever. Gerald Celente, the Global Trend Watcher, he will be back. Now, because Gerald can only ever do half an hour, we have another guest on this show who I think you will also like. Completely opposite end of the spectrum as far as guests goes, this man is a cryptologist who's done some pretty amazing work on hidden history right here in the UK. His name is Buff Parry, Louis Buff Parry, but he likes to be known as Buff, and he's in Canada. Fascinating man, and he's on right now on The Unexplained. So, Buff Parry, thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you know, I love the name, Buff. It almost reminded me of a character from that movie, Back to the Future.
Yes, I do avoid that kind of vowel inversion and slippage.
Because that was Biff.
Yeah, and we know what that's about.
but before we talk about your work, what are the origins of this name, Louis Buff Parry?
Well, my grandfather's, my mother's father's name was Louis, and he named me Buffalo, and Buffalo became Buffy when I was very young. And then I had the exceptional opportunity to see Buffy St. Marie.
Wow.
When I was about 12. And from that point on, I demanded that everyone stop calling me Buffy. And so I became Buff. But from day one, I was, referred to as Buffalo or Buffy.
Buffy St. Marie, I'm going to be a country boy again. Wasn't there a song?
Oh yes, I'm going to be a country boy again. Although it was, I'm going to be a country girl again, from her particular vantage.
Okay. Well, now we've
unless there's a mystery about Buffy that I don't know.
I'm sure there wasn't. So we've got the name sorted out now. And you're in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
That's correct, Art.
Mm-hmm. And is that a lifelong thing? You've always been in Canada?
No, I was born and raised in what is today called Silicon Valley. A funny anecdotal account about that. When I left where I grew up and went into the United States Air Force and then went on to university and so forth, I kept hearing about this place called Silicon Valley, and I never traced it at first and had no idea what anyone was talking about. And it turned out to be exactly where I had been, where I was born in San Mateo and then grew up southeast of San Mateo, which was San Jose. Mm.
Your biography is the longest biography of any guest I've ever seen. But it includes a number of educational establishments in that sort of area, doesn't it?
Yes, San Jose State College, for example, which I attended while I was still in high school. I was kind of in an accelerated context and category, and so I was able to take courses at university while I was finishing my high school.
I knew nothing about you, but I found one BBC article about you that describes you as a Canadian cryptologist. Is that a fair description?
I would say it's one of my vocations. Actually, a vocation that started sort of late in my life, about 15 or 20 years ago. But yes, it's fair to call me that today, given the number of decipherments or decodes I've conducted.
But mathematics is your thing, right?
No, not really. It's really hard to identify what is my thing, because I do a lot of things.
That's what baffled me about you, this incredible biography that you kept sending me portions of it and adding to it, because the stuff you do included music, and really a very well connected music.
Yes, but that, you know, that was in relation to writing librettos and poetry and some lyrics for music, but the actual music part of it, I don't write, although I decoded, and I think I'm the only one who actually successfully decoded the specific musical notations of Leonardo da Vinci. And we're not talking about all of the other hallucinations people are having when they think they're seeing Leonardo's encrypted music. He actually wrote music using notes, and no one has been able to perform them until I came along and I figured out how he did it and what direction to read them in. Everyone was reading from left to right, like you read music. But as he wrote in script, he wrote in music. He wrote them from right to left. And oddly, no one had tried to perform on a piano or any other instrument his musical notations. And I figured it out. He was using the 3-4-5 theorem, the 47th theorem of Pythagoras, which Euclid borrowed, and it's called a Euclidean 47th theorem, but it's really Pythagoras's theorem, and he applied that to the way that he composed and performed music.
Wow,
it's amazing.
So he was every bit as clever as we've been told, but more so.
More so, you know, when people exaggerate and go way out of the bounds in assigning to Leonardo all of his gifts, it's completely unnecessary to exaggerate or to stretch envelopes or any of that with him, because when just, you know, stay online with him and stick with what he's written. For example, people who've read his notebooks haven't even found what I'm about to tell you, but I discerned in a letter he wrote to a person he called Al Diodario, who turns out to be the Minister of Finance for Sultan Bayezid II. He identified what we can only call a UFO today, from a particularly fascinating location in what is today's Anatolia, and most people don't catch it. They don't discern what he's trying to say. He does everything he can to avoid any conclusions about whether they're angels or whatever else in, you know, in 1500, which would be about the time he had this experience, might have identified an object in the heavens. But, you know, he was talking about different climatological variations and so on, and light reflections and refractions. But when he when he got into the shape-shifting aspect of what he was looking at, you know, it really struck me. And then I looked at the footnote to the person who had compiled that particular set of notebooks, who was Jean-Paul Richter. And, you know, there is the translator and annotator suggesting that, you know, Leonardo tried his darndest to have a scientific explanation for what he was seeing.
So he wanted to rationalize it.
Well, he did. And I don't think, well, unless he was trying to code for some reason his experience and expected the Sultan's Minister of Finance to understand that code.
And so what exactly did he see?
Well, he saw an object fixed and then moving and then changing shape and then going back to its original shape. And it's about maybe six sentences in this extremely long letter.
And how clear and unambiguous from his writings is that?
Oh, it's clear. It's clear when he talks about it changing shape.
That for a reason, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm saying that for a reason, because that idea of something changing shape rapidly, of course, you hear in UFO accounts today all the time.
Absolutely. You know, that but my conclusion to all that is, all of my personal experiences aside, is that there's something organic about these things. There's something actually physically organic about them. If they do exist, and we can't attribute what we're seeing to something else, that shape-shifting aspect is to me organic. I can't explain any further what I'm getting at. You know, we know that space is not an ocean, although some are saying now it wasn't at a particular period. But that's my only conclusion. I'm trained a lot in biology, and maybe that's what's influencing me in drawing this conclusion. But that shape shifting aspect is, it seems to me, implying something actually physically organic.
So something that perhaps exists on a dimensional within a plane that we cannot fully sense, but nevertheless is, as you say, organic.
Yes, I mean we know what sort of bio-cybernetics are, and you know the interface between cybernetics and biological systems. So why couldn't, I mean, if we have an entity that is that advanced that it can do all of those things in between dimensions and get over those vast distances, well, why couldn't it also, you know, be a cyborgian vehicle, not just a vehicle of, you know, cyborgs or of aliens, but the vehicle itself being cyborgian? I don't see why we need to exclude that. Not that anybody's systematically excluding it, but I personally don't go just the opposite direction. I think it's, you know, if they exist and we're mistaking, you know, what they are by identifying them the way we have been, then I think there's a biological aspect to the actual Markavat, or the vehicle itself.
The reason I mentioned mathematics before, and perhaps was somewhat wrong about that, is that you come across to me, from what I read, to be a man who likes to, quote, decode mysteries. I get the feeling that if you were in World War II, then you would probably have been employed in some secret base in Nevada somewhere to decode and decrypt Nazi traffic communications.
Well, you've just hit it on the nose. When I took my United States Air Force examination, in the process of enlisting, I scored the highest score in detecting certain sound patterns in what's called the radio ops section of the test. And so yes, I would have been probably during the Second World War doing a whole lot of that kind of work.
I have a feeling you might have heard about this, and it's nothing really to do with the subject we were going on, the shortwave bands, and I thought it was very much something to do with the Cold War. When I was a boy, there were these stations broadcasting that just broadcast series of numbers, and sometimes in German, Neun, Sieben, just like that, random strings of numbers. And those stations, I understand, because there are people who study them, are still on air. And people believe it's something to do with spying or something covert. They're very powerful, but nobody's really worked out what the numbers are all about.
Well, it sounds like something I should tackle. Numbers are my favorite in terms of ways of coding. There are all kinds of ways of coding. But there are ancient numerical coding systems. They'd go back to the first trace in the Abjad system, for example, is Sargon, the Babylonian emperor. And so we know they've been in use for a long time, and the equivalency between a sound and a number was well understood thousands of years ago. And we still use those codes. So the strings of numbers would be interesting to look at if they seem random. To start to decipher something like that, you'd have to first get the pattern of where a length or a sequence of numbers begin and end. And if it's just one endless sequence, then it becomes a major difficulty. But I can tell you something. Sir Isaac Newton and I are in a competition over this very subject. Not that I see him often, but he put out a Bible code decipherment dealing with the Book of Daniel and the relationship between the Book of Daniel and Genesis in terms of numbers is awesome. It is eerie. Particularly considering who put all of that together, or in what sequences of groupings in time people put all of that together. And this does actually lend itself to some aspects of the code concerning the Shepherd's Monument.
Okay, which we want to get into, because of course it's right here in the UK, and I didn't realize that you were making news about this. Certainly the article I found on the BBC about you was 8 years ago. We'll talk about that in just a second, but I want to talk about the Bible code, because I've had a lot of people suggesting to me that we feature the Bible code on here, and other people who get in touch with me and say, Bible code, rubbish. Bible code, Schmeibel code, it's all rubbish. You actually think this exists? There is a code buried within the Old Testament?
Oh, absolutely. And rabbis have been studying it for a very long time. I want to tell you that they've missed the most important aspect of it, and it is the relationship between Genesis and Daniel. But just sticking with Genesis, when you go to chapter 47, verse 28, there's something called Setuma, which means in Hebrew to be closed off, and it's where in what's called the Megillah, this is the scroll that is unrolled in the synagogue, during services, that you don't see numbers in Hebrew or otherwise when you're dealing with the Megillah scroll of the Torah, but what you see are these lines of Hebrew letters, which are verses. And then they're separate. So many spaces, separate. So many white spaces separate one line from the other. The only, in the entire Hebrew Bible, the only two verses that are not separated are verse 27 and 28. They flow together. That is called Setuma, because it means that something has been closed off. And I'm going to, I'll give you the blockbuster to this. Fast track to Daniel, and there is in the ninth chapter of Daniel a verse about the Messiah. And don't forget that Daniel is the only book that the word Messiah is even used in. which is really interesting, not in the New Testament, but in the, you know, in the Hebrew Bible. The Messiah only is used a couple times, and they're both in the book of Daniel. And we're talking about chapter 9, 24, 25, and 26. And so there's a direct connection between the verse that it amongst those three that states explicitly the Messiah was closed off, that is the Setuma, closed off, hidden from, that relates to what was closed off between chapter 47, verse 27 and 28. So what is that all about?
So that's referencing to you that there is some knowledge of the Messiah that is hidden.
Oh, absolutely.
And can be decoded and unlocked by those who are able to do it, those who understand.
Yes, I mean, Isaac Newton spent a whole lot of time on this one, you know, and interestingly enough, it only surfaced that he had done this when Thomas Jefferson's copy of Isaac Newton's treatment of the Book of Daniel was found in the 1990s with Thomas Jefferson's initials on it.
So people who think that this was just something that emerged in the 1980s and 1990s and made a couple of Discovery Channel-style documentaries are absolutely wrong. It goes back as far as Isaac Newton.
Oh, yeah, and it's totally legitimate. And it's not just the Kabbalists of Judaism and, you know, those who aren't Jewish but still think they're Kabbalists. It's not just that part of Judaism. It's, you know, the Talmud population, those who study the Torah, who are Talmudists or, you know, the Talmud, they do this all the time. They all are fully aware that there are codes in numbers assigned. The real issue comes up when you get the 72 rabbis for 72 days, supposedly, translating the Hebrew Bible from Hebrew into Greek. And that's when you start getting numbers in terms of chapter and verse number assignments. Otherwise, in the Hebraic tradition, nothing is given those numbers. Sections have numbers, but not, and you know by the number of white spaces that separate sections when a new chapter is beginning and then what the verses are, because they're all separated from each other except these two verses that come under this title of Setuma.
So what is the message hidden within?
Well, that's the issue. If you fast track, and I broke this code, if you fast track from that Setuma in Genesis to Daniel, and you look and you study the numbers in Daniel that are associated with, you know, how long the Messiah is cut off, you find those numbers are reflecting chapter 47, verse 28. You see what I'm getting at? Because in verse 28, it states explicitly that Israel or Jacob lived for 147 years. Well, I'll quickly give you an example of how this works. 147 is 3 times 49. Mm-hmm. And 49 is a mystic number. It has to do with Jubilee years and so forth in the Bible and the current monarch, you know, of Britain, you know, goes through these Jubilee things. I drank some wild Jubilee beer, I have to tell you. I don't remember exactly what happened on the Jubilee, but this is a highly celebrated holiday system based on numerological reckonings.
So if you've got something that is three times that symbolic number, it's incredibly symbolic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when you just deal with numbers, you see patterns and clusters of three, and you assign it to numbers associated with them, and you have 147, that it, you know that that's 3 times 49, and then you see what's going on in chapter 49 of Daniel, and in the three key verses of Daniel associated with the Messiah. You know, it all becomes really startlingly self-evident. It's not, this is not, again, there's no pushing of an envelope here. I know the Bible code tradition that came out of the 80s and 90s, and that one, I'm skeptical of it, although there is a frequency that kind of disturbs me, you know, what's called the Bible code. There's a, you know, a book, I can't remember the author and the person who was conducting the codes, but I've looked at it carefully, and there is a kind of a anomalous frequency of names that pop out, but you are bound to get a huge number of names when you throw it all together.
That's what critics of the Bible code have said, isn't it? That if you're looking for order in anything, then if you look hard enough, you'll probably find it.
Exactly. And in this case of that Bible code, what they do is that all is Satuma, because they push all the verses together into numbers and or not even into numbers, just into the lettering, and then they find, you know, diagonal spellings of different personalities. But by pushing it all together without spaces, that is Satuma. And strangely enough, the real primary verifiable Bible code is based on the only Satuma that exists, and that's again the one in chapter 47 between verse 27 and 28.
So what are we being told in all of this then? Are we being told that there is a Messiah, there was a Messiah, and the Messiah will come again?
Well, when Isaac Newton's paper was, when it resurfaced, Hebrew University built a great big display case for it and showed it for weeks and months, because it announced the time that the Messiah would emerge. So in Israel, Jews rallied around Isaac Newton, although, you know, he maintained his Christianity to the end. They rallied around him because what they did was forgive him for what they thought to be his mistaken notion that there was a second coming of Jesus. Rather, it was the first coming of the Davidic Messiah to the Jewish population. But still, they accepted that he had broken a code, and so the heralding and the celebration of Isaac Newton's treatment of Daniel at that level at Hebrew University, I think is evidence and proof positive that it's very acceptable in Judaism. It's totally acceptable to me, although I think he was right off the mark in terms of the date. That, you know, according to his calculation, the date of the emergence of the Messiah was supposed to be 1967, and that was because Israel had won the great famous war of 1967, and the only way it could have been done was, you know, by the miraculous presence of the Davidic Messiah. That's how that reasoning goes from a Jewish perspective.
So what's the current thinking on this then?
Well, I mean, I'm not, and by the way, I'm not saying I'm a believer in a coming of the Messiah. I'm not saying I am, though. If you calculate the code the way I did, you come to 2022 rather than 1967. But, you know, a 55-year separation is not that much of a discrepancy between the conclusion that Isaac Newton reached and the one I did. And I think, honestly, we are the only two who did this.
But whether all of this is right or whether it's wrong, the very idea that people so long ago could encrypt and encode things, and the thought of why would they want to do that, it's utterly fascinating, isn't it?
Well, it is. Sargon did it. Emperor Sargon, Babylonian emperor, did it because he wanted his name and his identity, you know, coded in all of the architecture and urban planning layouts that he directed.
So it's a way of making your name live on when paper will go to dust and everything else fades away. Here's a way that you can survive.
Everything else other than writings in stone. That's the unique aspect of carvings in stone and in clay tablets and so forth, because those will last for, you know, not forever, but, you know, for a much longer time than parchment, vellum, paper, and so on.
So why bother to code things?
Well, there, I think in Sargon's example, there, you know, it was largely just for self gratification, because his ego was so huge. It was as big as his empire. And given that he did it, you can be sure that it was practiced long before with cuneiform and so on. But I think otherwise, the reason for doing it, like the Knights Templar did a whole lot of coding, and they used Hebrew. That itself was a code because nobody else could, you know, read it but Jesuits, although they came much later after the rise and fall of the Templars. You know, it's to keep secrets. It's to pass messages. It's to be covert and clandestine.
Now, you know that the only reference to you I found on the net, I must admit, I didn't look too intensively, but the first thing that came up was a BBC piece. And this BBC piece, I think, is from 2006. And I'd never heard this story, but I'll just read it. It says, a Canadian cryptologist believes part of the Holy Grail lies in or close to a Staffordshire estate. Louis Buff Parry has spent 2 years studying letters etched on a monument in Shugborough, which are widely believed to be some sort of code. 2 years ago, experts from Bletchley Park, that's the great code-breaking place, of course, involved in World War II and everything else, decided the letters rumoured to be linked to the Grail were a message from an 18th-century Christian sect. Mr. Buff Parry said, it's a message, the Grail is buried nearby. Wow. I mean, look, all I know about Shugborough is when you drive north on the M6 motorway in the UK, there are signs to this country estate, which is a tourist attraction, everywhere. Beyond that, until I read this, I knew nothing. Fill me in.
The first I learned about the Shepherd's Monument, and it's upon the Shepherd's Monument that this cipher is carved.
So that's a big stone monument at Shugborough.
Yes, it's a beautiful monument. It's quite outstanding, and it's fairly well known. Maybe not fairly, but it's known for people who have ever read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, for example. It's referred to there, and that was my first learning about it by reading what Bajan Lincoln and Lee had to say about that monument. And then I put it aside. I didn't bother. I had won this competition that UNESCO had sponsored and was held in Iran, of all places, on geographers of the Islamic world. So I was in Iran. I came in first out of 300 entries. And so the government of Iran flew me and, you know, drove me all across the country. That was my sort of prize for having come in first. And when I came back to Canada, I was trying to catch up with, you know, some of the editions of the Edmonton Journal that I had missed. And so I read in one of the editions that came out in my absence, I had read about this kind of challenge that was put out to code breakers of the world to break this inscription on the Shepherd's Monument. And it just intrigued me because I had remembered what Bajan Lincoln and Lee had to say about it. And I'm highly critical of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but they did a tremendous job, I think, in terms of a comprehensive treatment of some aspects of history that are so not known. And that stuck in my mind, what they had said about the Shepherd's Monument. And then seeing it in the newspaper, learning that Bletchley Park had put out this challenge in conjunction with the British Trust. Richard Kemp, who was an officer of British Trust at the time and manager of Bletchley Park, Shugborough Hall.
You mean the UK, no, the National Trust, yeah?
Yeah, yes, pardon me, not manager of Bletchley Park. That was Christine Larch, but Richard Kemp was the manager of Litchfield Estate, Shugborough Hall, where the Shepherd's Monument is. When I read about that challenge, you know, it didn't take me very long to put some things together, and I broke the code. But over time, more and more became apparent to me. And now, what I didn't release in the initial 2004 release that the London Times did a full page spread on in the front section of the London Times, and this was I think in at the end of November in 2004, and they referred to my work. When that happened, I hadn't really completely articulated all of the elements in my decipherment because it's so massive and convoluted and requires some familiarity with Hebrew. It requires familiarity with the Bible. It requires all of that. So I left out the intrinsic way that something that was inside of Shugborough Hall itself was required in order to decipher the code on the monument. And that's a painting of Lady Anson, and she was holding the first version of Nicolas Poussin's work, Shepherds of Arcadia. And what's carved on the Shepherd's Monument outside is Nicolas Poussin's second version of the Shepherds of Arcadia. So you can't decipher that code without knowing what's in the first painting, Shepherds of Arcadia by Nicolas Poussin, and the second one that is carved in marble on the Shepherd's Monument. I'll tell you why you know that you have to use it. First of all, so many elements in the first version of the Shepherds of Arcadia let me put it this way. In the first version of the Shepherds of Arcadia, you've got key indicators associated with Rachel, Jacob, Benjamin, and Joseph. Okay, so those you find in Nicolas Poussin's first version of Shepherds of Arcadia. In Genesis, the whole account of Joseph and Benjamin, the sons of Rachel and Jacob, you know, have all those indicators, and so you have to put the two together. You have to put the book of Genesis together with the first first Shepherds of Arcadia, and then go with that combined to the second Shepherds of Arcadia that's carved on the Shepherd's Monument, and then you have it. But the problem is, for me, self-evident reasons, but maybe not for a lot of people, they took that painting and made a new painting exactly the same of Lady Anson, but instead of her holding the first version of Shepherds of Arcadia, she's holding an image of a Greek person holding a Greek book and reading it. So there was a, for whatever reason, and by the way, the second Lady Anson painting is vastly inferior to the first, although they're identical, or there's an attempt to make them identical, but for the replacement of the first version of the Shepherds of Arcadia in her hand with this Greek book that is now presently in her hand in the copy of Lady Anson that is in Shugborough Hall.
So the dumb guy's question, which I'm going to ask now, is the fact that you have these two paintings and you have this monument and they are all connected, why? Why would they be connected? What were they trying to say?
That this so-called grail that I'm saying is at Shugborough Hall is one of the two stones called the Bethel Stones that were carried in an ark, and you can see that ark, by the way, carved into the Shepherd's Monument depiction of the Shepherds of Arcadia. It's placed on top of a tomb, so it's right there for everyone to see. This is the ark that the tribe of Ephraim, who was the second son of Joseph when Israel was exiled in Egypt. Okay, he grows up, he spawns his own tribe, the tribe of Ephraim. They're still in Egypt. That tribe carried around his grandfather's, that is Ephraim's grandfather's, and the grandfather being Jacob or Israel, pillow stone, you know, the famous stone of destiny, but the real one. carrying that around in that ark with the stone, the headstone on the grave of Rachel, Ephraim's grandmother or Joseph's mother. So those two, this is a Jewish tradition that is well understood. Jewish Encyclopedia has a whole big article on it, that this ark was carried long before the Ark of the Covenant in Egypt by Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim. So that's how these two stones become associated with the Grail. Because if you fast track into Wolfram von Eschenbach and his, you know, his medieval treatment of the Grail, he says that the stone is the Grail. He never states so explicitly that the chalice is the Grail. So the stone to which he refers is, in my understanding, and not only mine, the Pillar Stone of Jacob.
And that's at Shugborough.
Yes.
And how does this change what we understood? What does it mean?
Well, it means a whole lot of things. It exposes a whole lot, too. It exposes the degree of Jacobite presence and involvement that was going on with the Anson family, because it was the Jacobites who had that stone. And according to Master Mason Joe Lang at Roslyn, was kept at Roslyn Chapel. And in one of the documentaries that is all about this work I've done, Joe is featured in it as well. Joe Lang, Joe takes me right to the site where he believes that that Pillow Stone of Jacob was kept. We're not talking about the coronation stone, you know, that's kept in the castle that hovers over Edinburgh. That is not the original.
The Stone of Scone.
Yeah, that's not the original Jacob's Pillow Stone. Can you imagine Jacob trying to stand it up? I mean, if you read the biblical account, He stands up the Pillow Stone that he had his head on, and from which he saw the stairway to heaven. You know, and Led Zeppelin's song always comes to mind in that regard. He's sleeping. He's looking at the stairway to heaven, and the angels are going up and down that stairway. So this stone becomes precious, and you know, many people say it by one means or another ended up in Scotland, and even the Picts used it for their coronation practices. But something happened, and Joe Lang is the person who tells the story best, that caused the shifting from that the real Pillow Stone of Jacob to that monstrosity that is encased in that showcase in the castle above Edinburgh, looking over Edinburgh. There's a whole lot of people that don't buy the idea that stone can possibly be the Pillow Stone of Jacob or the coronation stone, original coronation stone, because in the original account, Jacob stands it upright. In Hebrew, the term for doing that is Eben Shetiyah, standing the stone upright. And he pours oil, anointing oil on it, and he vows to vow. That's literally how it's referred to in the English translation of Genesis. He vows to vow as he's pouring the anointing oil on the stone.
So this enormously important artifact is at Shugborough, and there are two paintings that were done that were designed to tell you that, if you were clever enough to work it out.
No, not the painting. The paintings were done before that stone arrives at Shugborough. There's a whole chapter that we've omitted here that we need to include to understand that sequencing. The Admiral Anson commandeered some ships in a French fleet that were moving from Canada, and this is how Oak Island Money Pit gets dragged into this. Strangely, I didn't do it, but Nick Fielding did in his treatment of my decipherment in the London Times. It was on its way to the Count of Maurepas, who was the Secretary of State under King Louis XV. And Admiral Anson commandeers, and this is on record, he commandeers this whole part of the fleet. And so he whatever booty was on the fleet, treasure and otherwise, he took. And that included this stone. And I'm certainly of the mind that he knew that stone was being transported But let me quickly, because we may be getting short in time here, get to one of the points. The Battle of Culloden was the last great battle of the Jacobites uprising, and there was a huge amount of gold that was coming from, quote, a French source, that was en route to the area of Culloden in Scotland. Well, it turns out that after they lost, the Jacobites lost their final battle, that is to say, until the American Revolution, which was the ultimate fulfillment of the Jacobite movement, when they lost the final battle in UK or in Great Britain, called the Battle of Culloden, this shipment of gold arrives. You've got archaeologists and BBC, by the way, doing a whole lot of work on this, I think even to this day. And the because of a certain letter that was found, a mea culpa letter of a person who had taken some of the treasure, they've been able to track it down further. And the letter is, you know, a person who said that he had stolen from the treasure, but when he learned that it was his beloved Prince Bonnie, Prince Charles Edward Stuart, you know, who was supposed to have this treasure, he felt all guilty and so on. So that letter becomes very important in this investigation. But what I'm saying is the idea at Oak Island here in Nova Scotia, Canada, that there is this gold treasure, and there's a very good reason to believe that there was a gold treasure there from the Concepcion, which was a ship that was bearing treasure and silver, the silver of which was delivered directly to King James II the year before he was deposed. The gold on that ship, I'm saying, was stored on Oak Island, and it in fact was delivered, but to the Jacobites. The Jacobites, however, had already failed. They had lost their rebellion, and the purpose of their rebellion in Britain. And so, you know, it was the origins of the current monarchy that ended up, you know, getting all that gold. So, you know, there are a whole lot of codes and ciphers and hidden aspects to this whole thing I've just told you.
But wow.
getting back to the point, getting back mm-hmm. to the point of this Grail stone, the Pillow Stone of Jacob, the Anson captured it from one of the ships in Le Jonquière's fleet in 1746, I think is without question. Because it was in 1746 that gold also arrived, and so the gold coming from Oak Island, the stone tablet coming from the Jesuits, because it was Le Verendrye, one of the first Europeans supposedly to set eyes on the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, Le Verendrye, who found it in a hollowing in a pillar, which, by the way, is part of the translation of the Hebrew code that's carved onto the Hebrew part of the code that's carved onto the Shepherd's Monument. And let me tell you that the people in the area of Lichfield at the time of the Ansons included some Jesuits, and all the Jesuits knew Hebrew. So, and the Ansons were those fence straddling kind of aristocrats. You know, they were right in the middle between whether they should go with the Jacobite movement or in case they did recover the throne, or go to William of Orange and, you know, so all of that. And then the descendants of William of Orange, who ended up being the King George, first, second, third, and so forth. You know, so they were very careful and cautious about where their loyalties would be, right up into into 1746, when all of this happened, when the stone was delivered, first captured by Anson from Le Jonquière, and then the gold was delivered. And Le Jonquière is important because he was bringing all of this to the Secretary of State. And this Count of Maurepas is the person who redesigned part of the sacristy in Église Saint-Sulpice, famous in the Da Vinci Code. And who was he? He was the kingpin of the European base of supporters of the Jacobite movement in Britain.
So there was a whole undercover operation going on, and it was all centered kind of around Anson and around Shugborough.
You've got it.
Wow.
You've got it. Anson, the two brothers, the Anson brothers, and I went through their archives. Believe me, I went through them. You can ask Andrew Baker, who is pretty well known in your part of the world, who writes books about, you know, these great places in Britain. The two brothers used to go and watch the Jacobites marching on their own property and meet with them, not try to prevent them from marching on down to London.
So Thomas Anson, the then Earl, we have to say he was the Earl there at the time, if we haven't said this already, which we have, but just to underline that, was a massively important figure in history.
Hugely. Hugely, and is only now becoming known in terms of his Masonic and Rosicrucian linkages that you find all over Shugborough, the inside of Shugborough Hall. Absolutely central. And he was smart enough to straddle the fence, not go with the Jacobites after they lost two of their greatest uprisings, but also carefully not be overly embracing, you know, of the new monarchies, or what the Jacobites called the usurpers of the throne of England and of Scotland.
So the stone that is there, what was his intention for it then? Did he want it to be discovered by somebody like you sometime in the future?
Well, I think yes. I think he obviously knew its role in the quote New Jerusalem. You know, and I mean, all these new things, like, you know, the New Atlantis, the New Jerusalem, Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. And I want to say hello to my friends at the Francis Bacon Society, because I know they're going to be listening to this. They've been made aware of it. They're all over my work. I don't agree with a large part of what they're saying, because they say they designed that Francis Bacon designed the money pit at Oak Island. And it's too old for that. And there's evidence now of its use long before the time of Francis Bacon, but he may have had a role in it. So anyway, the new Atlantis and the New Jerusalem have a linkage in terms of conceptual works that the great people like.
Okay, because we are coming to the end of our time here, and I know that we could talk for hours about this, and we have to hook up again and talk. For people who are, I mean, I'm ashamed of the fact that I'm not as au fait with British history, United Kingdom history, as I should be. But, I was a child of the television age, and popular culture was where I was at. I've had to catch up on a lot of this stuff only recently. For people like me listening to this, what does this mean?
It means that, assuming that the stone is buried on Lichfield Estate, if there's a massive excavation project and it surfaces, we have to be very careful about what is done with it, given what it will do in Jerusalem, since the tradition associated with it has Solomon, using it for incense burning purposes, incense being burned over it in the Sanctum Sanctorum and things like that. It those who want the final temple and so on, they're going to, they will want this as one of the appurtenances, one of the articles that are required for the final temple. But I can tell you, you can keep in touch by going to what's not yet posted, but is about to be posted. It's a new YouTube channel called Truth in the Buff. And there will be a whole lot on this subject and the newer developments, posted on that channel.
I love the title, and I love your intensity and the dedication to your work that you show.
Well, I first learned about the discovery of this stone in 1974, reading Alexander von Humboldt. And there's a new breakthrough on Alexander von Humboldt. He's the one who said that so much happened in 1746, like the movement of the stone, when all the others who recorded when it was moved said 1743. He said 1746, and he was dead on. So he was in the inner circle of a particular group. We can get into it the next time we have this conversation. But it was 1974 when I first became aware of this stone, as it was reported on in a book called Views of Nature by Alexander von Humboldt. And I haven't been able to leave this mission since then.
Well, this stuff is at the cutting edge of what they call today hidden history, isn't it?
It sure is.
Wow.
And it has such tangible, substantial bases to it. You know, I mean, you can go right to all of these different... Who was Alexander von Humboldt, after all? He's the founder of modern geography. He founded ecology, the science of ecology, and volcanology, Alexander von Humboldt is one of those great towering figures called the Renaissance man, although he wasn't from the Renaissance, in human history. And his treatment of all this is so legitimate and verifiable. Everything I've said is verifiable. The issue becomes, and it's in the documentary that was filmed on this. The issue is what happens if it is dug up there. And I'm saying dug up. I don't have evidence that it's actually in the ground. It could be stashed somewhere in Shugborough Hall, given that's where that painting was, too. It could be.
If people want to read about you, where do they go?
Holy smokes. Google my name. And there's a website that's about 2 years in need of updating, but it's www.lewisbuffperry.com. Buff. That has the listing of everywhere I give, presentations and so on.
Well, it's been quite a journey we've been on, Buff. Thank you very much indeed. And I think we've only just kind of written half of chapter one. I think there are many chapters to go.
Well, I look forward to co-authoring with you.
Thank you very much indeed, Buff. All the best.
Thank you.
Buff Parry, one show, two guests. Before Buff Parry, you heard Gerald Celente. Your views on this show welcome, your guest suggestions and communications always welcome. Get in touch with me through the website, www.theunexplained.tv. Designed and created by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Until next we meet here on The Unexplained, please stay safe, stay calm, stay warm as well, and stay in touch. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.